core, what is the heart of the life of faith. And all of this is hopefully going to connect, and you can hopefully choose some more on the book and the core values in your small groups that are meeting. And if you're not connected to a small group, if you want to see one of the members of our small group team, Kathy is back here, Renee is right over here, and Marcy here today, or she's not, or you can see me and let us know. We'd love to get you connected with a small group. So the central message, our credo at the Barn, is love wins, and love wins spells out our core values. So I'm going to invite you to read the core values with me. Balance, hope, creativity, a state of community, growth, gratitude, honesty, and all neighbors. So this morning, we're going to focus on the core value of a safe community. So before we unpack what a safe community looks like, I'm wondering, how do you feel when you're in a safe community? How does it feel? Start with that. I asked for that, right, didn't I? Yeah, I did. Okay, so how does it feel when you know you're in a safe community?
Comfortable.
Peaceful.
Sense of unity.
Sense of unity.
Like you're part of it and included.
Like you're included. There's belonging.
Yeah.
Relaxed. Happy.
Like you don't want to leave.
Like you don't want to leave. Yeah.
You can sleep.
Sleep at night. Yeah. And rest.
Sound on their hand.
You don't have to pretend. You can be your authentic self. Yes. What else? You can be yourselves, right, in a safe community. So let's try to define a safe community. This is a harder task. You know what it feels like? So I Googled the definition of a safe community. If you ever want to get yourself into trouble or walk into a mousetrap, just Google something, right? So this is what Google says is the definition of a safe community. A safe community is a place that is attractive to live, work, and visit. A safe community is a livable community where people can go about their daily activities in an environment without fear, risk, or risk of harm or injury. I think that's awkward, but that's okay. I probably copied that one. So what are your first thoughts on this definition? What does this make you think of? Family, right? Like a place where your family could live, the same community, right? Is that just being with family as a community? Okay. Dan?
You know, when I read that, I feel like it's a little bit too physical. Like, I feel like, you know, there isn't harm, injury, like, I feel like you don't, like, while that's great and needed for a safe community, I feel like a safe community is also something that kind of lets you do yourself. And maybe that's a little bit of a fear thing, but I still think as I read that, it's a little bit more severe, if you will. Like if I go to, like, a KKK rally, like, you guys are, you know, risk, harm, injury, I'm thinking just a place where you can be yourself and not quite as extreme as harm or injury, but just be able to be yourself and not like walk on eggshells.
Right. What else? Other thoughts?
A place for just personal growth without, you know, being held down or injured or whatnot.
Yeah. Do you hear about this? That's what I thought you were doing. That's why I wanted to double check that. Sandy?
I do think that instead of safe community is a whole community, meaning that if you're really living, you are moving towards growth.
Yeah.
Well, not me is the attractive part. Like, does it have to be? I'm sure we all want our communities to be attractive, but it doesn't have to be. It's like might be attractive to one person, but it's not really attractive to someone.
Right. Right, so livable implies growth, but what does attractive mean, right? And that's subjective too, right? What does it mean to be livable as objective? What does it mean, like, what does it mean for a community to be attractive? Kathy?
So, I want to hear your point here, because that fear is a part of
One. For safe community, first it would give crime statistics. And the next thing, the next article would be about integrated health and well-being. And the next article would be about security systems. And the next article would be about a public organization bringing different pieces of community together. So it seemed like, as I'm looking at this, there is a tension within a safe community between how do you protect the people within the community, and how do you then have this brave, integrated way of risking within a safe community? So the tension between these two aspects, I think, help us to understand and unpack what it means to live in a safe community. So a community that is willing to risk, a community that has healthy boundaries at the same time. Because we want to feel good, we want to trust, we want to be able to sleep at night. And I think God also wants growth from us. That physical, emotional, and spiritual growth and health and well-being. So can you think of a situation where you would put yourself at risk of harm or injury? Where you would do that intentionally? Sammy?
I'm not going to answer that.
Okay, you're not answering.
But I'm going to go back to what you just said, because I think one thing, something we need to consider, because we're all close here, we're trauma-informed, then we realize that people who have experienced some kind of trauma, which is their children or when they're young, and they're constantly living in a heightened sense of fear for their survival, they cannot cognitively reach those stages where they're learning and growing. Because the stress of that constant fear for their safety and their well-being is physiologically inhibits that from happening. So I think, I don't know if most of us in here grow, I grew up in a very safe, comfortable kind of neighborhood and everything, so I didn't have that, so it's hard for me to imagine that, but if we become poverty and talk to some people, then we're aware
it's very different, right? That's why I wanted, because we have to acknowledge that this doesn't exist all the time. And for some people and some children, where there's trauma, where there's hurt, where there's abuse, it's very different. So what I'm hoping that I might be able to imagine is there a situation where you would put yourself at risk? So, Dan?
I think in most scenarios, we're involved with children. Whatever that would mean, most scenarios that involve your children, you don't have to put yourself at risk before anything bad would happen to them.
Yes.
So the obvious answer is harm, right? And one of the reasons that I like being here in this
that's Kathy's point. It's challenging. And I wouldn't feel apprehensive explaining or expressing the view that I have, even knowing that it's controversial, because even though there may be pushback, let's say Kathy and I have something totally different in mind about one particular situation, I can express that in this situation because it's safe, yet it's, I'm afraid not to do it because I know that it's safe in that expression, right? So, like, for me, a safe community isn't a place that's where I go not the fear of risk of harm or injury, but the ability to challenge in a productive way. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Cheryl?
Yeah. Getting off of this, when you're looking at community, as a former teacher, I consider the school community and the time that I have put myself at risk to save my students.
Yes. Yes, that's a great example, because you see if the students become, like Dan said, with a child, you know, when it's your own child. Can you think of another situation where that second?
I personally am not trained to use the firefighters who always go
running. Yeah, that's another great example where you would risk that harm or injury for the safety of others. Cindy?
I think it goes across this idea of when there's something bigger than ourselves. And what popped in my mind is military. And I personally haven't served, but you have people who are willing to risk harm, injury, even death because they believe in a cause that is so much bigger than their individual being, which is pretty amazing.
Right. And I think that, to go back to something Sandy said earlier, I think there's a difference between having healthy boundaries and a clear sense of why you're going into a situation, risking yourself, which is, you know, in autonomy, that I can make a decision for myself, is different from the risk of harm in an abusive situation, which is not where there are no healthy boundaries, where there is abuse or other adverse risk factors like neglect or mental abuse or addiction or any of those factors which can adversely affect someone else, right, which is, does the opposite of create a healthy community. So what I would like to do, thinking about the definition, I mean, about what it lives to be, what it means to live in a safe community, I'd love to read this story from the Gospel of Matthew together. It's about a woman who risked her reputation for healing and safety, for the healing and safety of her daughter. So let's read this together. From there, Jesus took a trip to Tyre and Sidon. They had hardly arrived when a Canaanite woman came down from the hills and pleaded, "Mercy, Son of David, my daughter is cruelly afflicted by an evil spirit." Jesus ignored her. The disciples came and complained, "Now she's bothering us. Would you please take care of her? She's driving us crazy." Jesus refused, telling them, "I've got my hands full dealing with the lost sheep of Israel." Then the woman came back to Jesus, went to her knees, and begged, "Master, help me." He said, "It's not right to take bread out of children's mouths and throw it to dogs." She was quick. "You're right, Master. Every dog do get scraps from the master's table." Jesus gave in. "Oh, then your faith is something else. What you want is what you get. Right then, your daughter can be healed." So Jesus and his disciples are traveling through the country, and at this point in the story of Matthew's Gospel, Jesus is becoming known as a healer, as a wisdom teacher, and as a movement initiator. Mark is born in this chapter. In his book, he's talking about Jesus, and he delineates between the pre-Easter Jesus, the Jesus as we know, the historical Jesus, and the post-Easter Jesus, who's the Jesus of tradition as the church understood him. And he said that this pre-Easter Jesus was a man who was a healer, a wisdom teacher, a movement initiator, and a Jewish mystic. Because he's a person who experiences God's presence in the every day-to-day reality of life. So people are coming to Jesus to experience God's presence for healing and casting out evil spirits. And Jesus is also a social prophet. He is a person who cares about the marginalized, cares about people who are cast aside, shows preferential treatment for the poor, and he says, you are included in God's kingdom. So more and more people are following Jesus as he makes his way through the countryside. So it is at this point in Matthew, in our story today, that this Canaanite woman approaches Jesus to ask for healing for her daughter who has been afflicted with an evil spirit. So what do you know about what it means to be a Canaanite? Anything that you might be able to know? And this is a really subtle but important distinction in this story. Bob, what do you know about being a
promised land and God let the Jews come in and slaughter them all?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, and that takes place in the Old Testament during the time of Joshua. The Hebrew people, the Canaanites, are settled in the promised land, and the Hebrew people move into the promised land and conquer this people. So there is great animosity between these two tribes, between the Canaanites and the Jews. There are ethnic differences, heritage differences, religious differences between these two groups, and the animosity is so deep between these two tribes that in Deuteronomy it says that the people are called to annihilate them. So not only is the Canaanite woman separated and socially marginalized based on her ethnicity, she is also marginalized because she is a woman. And there are certain expectations around how a woman should behave in public. And she's not following those rules. She's shouting. She's crying out. She is publicly approaching men, and she is demanding of Jesus that he heals her daughter. And at first, the disciples recognize this offense. And they're like, she is driving us crazy. Like, get rid of this woman. Quiet her. Put her in her place. And Jesus ignores her, right? He's better things to do. He has to take care of his own tribe, the people of Israel. But this Canaanite woman, she refuses to be put in her place. She has faith, and she is firm in her faith, and she is firm in her own conviction, and she is firm in her own skin, and she is brave. And she knows that Jesus can help her. And she recognizes the tribalism that exists and the social barriers that keep them apart, and she names them, and she risks everything anyway because this is her daughter who she loves. And she confronts Jesus saying, even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. A metaphor for her belief in God, that God cares for even the lowest of people. And then, Jesus is changed. There was a conflict between these perspectives. Conflict of needs, conflict of tribes. And this woman risks everything. And Jesus is, he knows who he is, right? He's a healer, he's a teacher, he's a man who's bringing God's kingdom. But in this encounter, he is changed. He's willing to listen to this woman who's risking everything. And he builds understanding. He is changed and he crosses those boundaries and he is willing to bend because, yes, God's kingdom is available to all people. That's it.
I totally disagree.
Oh! Let's go!
Let's go. I don't think he's been one inch. I knew it all the time by giving her and his apostles a wall that they had overcome. Just like the woman in Jericho, they were going around and she had faith. And so that was 1,000 years before that. God raised up and honored belief wherever it exists. That doesn't mean God doesn't know that this woman was right. But by saying what Jesus said, he brought her faith forward. And it's not that for her faith, but he's taught us than all the other people around us. I don't think
so you think he knew, but Do you think that even in his knowing and in his example of changing that he was teaching his disciples? So we're still getting to the same place, but in a different, from a different perspective. Very right. So, like thinking about pre-teachers and sort of post-teachers, we can think very differently, but we're coming to a similar place. Maybe I can do that too. So I saw other hands. Did I see other hands? Matt.
I've always had problems with this, and I didn't like how Jesus tended to be someone who responded. And I felt he was trying to improve, but I guess that was expected with the pain in mind. But he compared it to the dog.
He did. He became a minister.
Yeah.
It wasn't just her. It was all Canaanites. Because he said dogs.
Yes.
So he was being racist at that moment.
Yeah, it's tribe against tribe. Right? And this was very alive as well. Like, to the point, like, we're very clearly in Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 17. When I found this, let me just make sure I'm telling you.
Go back to the book. There's no issue. You can write.
Yeah, here. No. So right here. So it's on the next one. So she's driving them crazy. So she bends down and says, "Master, help me." And he says, "No, right? It's not right to take bread out of the children of Israel's mouths and throw it to the dogs, the Canaanites."
Okay.
Yeah. And she's quick, right? You're right, Master. You beg your dogs. You get scraps from the master's table. She has tremendous faith in confronting him, right? And she has wisdom for him. And she's willing to risk everything for the healing of her daughter.
He's showing his disciples. He's not saying to her at all.
But you think he's just showing them?
Yeah.
So, Alex.
Well, first of all, I don't think she was that.
Yeah, and in his bending, he does that. He brings these people together.
Right.
Renee?
I'm just going to say, perhaps.
Yeah,
I don't think we really know
he was human. He was 100% human, and he was changed. And we fixate so much on being Jesus as being perfect instead of on his goodness, his righteousness, and his ability to change. And that to me gives me such hope because then I can say, there's no more things. Yeah, I have a story today about Joseph Park, and how Joseph Park was an inspiration. And it was, in fact, she just was true to her being. And she had had enough, essentially. It was tired, and she changed. And when people can make those beautiful things and change, the culture, they are the rocks.
Yeah.
I really think that she didn't hear the story. It was kind of cool. Like, I have all these things. I don't know. Like, So one of the biggest risks that we take in creating a self-community is we risk conflicts, right? I mean, we're doing it now. We're having all these different ways of approaching a text, the way we're talking about differences in perspective and understanding and experience. This is rich. Right, and how we're listening to one another. And it's safe to agree to disagree. But I think even engaging in this activity is really a gift. And when we can come together in community, we can talk about really tough issues, whether it be politics or racism or money, wealth, or poverty, or abortion, or privilege. I mean, there are these big topics that we tend to become tribal and conflicted about, and instead, when we come together, and what is it that can bring us together so that we can have these conversations in a safe community? So I invite you to watch this video together.
I personally, I feel uncomfortable around conflict.
Now we're here today to find out how to argue.
But conflict is useful. The question is, how do you deal with conflict most effectively? Here we go. I am author of Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Have you found yourself in an argument that felt so frustrating, so at a core aggravating?
That's the silliest opinion I've ever heard.
It felt so non-negotiable. Congratulations, you're a human being. We all experience conflict. And seeing what's going on in our world today, my hunch is you were probably having at least one of these conflicts about politics. Our country is tribal trap. Anything that that other side says, I shall not believe, I shall not give any credibility to, and I'm going to do everything I can to prove I'm right, you're wrong, and to stifle you down to raise me up. The problem is not with the what. What are we arguing about? The problem is with the how.
How
can we be more effective? And what I've found is that there's three big barriers that we can actually overcome to have more effective conversations. The big things: one, identity; two, appreciation; and three, affiliation. Let's start with identity.
First of all, this is a hot issue.
Why do we get so emotional in these conflict situations? It often goes back to something deeper: identity. What are the core values, the core beliefs that are feeling threatened inside of you as you're having that conversation with the other side? The moment your identity gets hooked in these conflicts, all of a sudden your emotions become 100 times more powerful. Boy, this is a wholly different conflict now. It's now your pride. Your sense of self is on the line. You need to know who you are and what you stand for. What are the values and beliefs that are driving me to fight for this stance on this issue? The more you understand who you are, the more you can try to get your purpose met and stay balanced, even when the other threatens those core values and beliefs. Each side wants to feel appreciated, and if the last thing they want to do is to appreciate the other side, that's a problem.
Listen and understand.
When you're in the midst of the conflict, don't talk. Take the first 10 minutes consciously listen to the other side. What's the value behind their perspective? What's the logic, the rationale? Why do they hold this perspective on immigration or healthcare? Once you truly understand and see the value of their perspective, let them know, I hear where you're coming from. You know what? That makes sense. There is nothing more in the world that we like than to feel appreciated. Recognize your power to appreciate them. Third, affiliation. What's the emotional connection like between you and the other side? We typically approach these conflict situations as me versus you, my opinion on healthcare versus yours, my party's perspectives on immigration versus yours. That's just going to leave the two of you like rams butting heads.
Find common ground.
Turn that other person from an adversary into a partner. So it's no longer me versus you, but the two of us facing the same shared problem. Ask the other person, look, what's your advice on how we can get as many of our interests met at the same time? Change the nature of your conversation. Now, you put these three things into practice, it can transform your relationships. Imagine what would happen if we started a revolution, but a positive revolution, a greater understanding, greater appreciation, greater affiliation, how we can transform politics, how we can transform our country and ultimately our world. I believe it's possible, but it starts with each one of us.
So while we were watching the video, I think my husband decided it was time to create a conflict. Do you mind standing up? I told him I was going to get on. But this does assume that both people have a healthy sense of self, and also have healthy boundaries and are able to communicate with one another. Yes. What are other thoughts, Marcy?
Well, one of the other things is when we're talking to somebody that has a different sort of opinion, I want to know your rationale. So that so I have to listen, and I kind of probe and say,
of safe, healthy boundaries. So the first is the belief that every person is a child of God, right? And how you engage, like I would not recommend engaging with someone who does not have healthy boundaries or is coming from an unhealthy place. You're just going to do this, right? So you have to have that awareness. But if you believe that every person is a child of God and treat every person with dignity and respect, the willingness to listen without stepping on someone's toes, it allows for a space where you can take risks and into areas that might be uncomfortable in a way that recognizes the worth of every person. So the other touch point that I have is active listening. Listening is the key to creating a safe community, listening deeply without trying to formulate a response, but listening to hear what is common as well as what is different from your own understanding. This goes to the affiliation, seeing people as partners. Listening invites questions to probe more deeply, and it also helps to clarify the other person's perspective. A third touch point is honest expression. This is speaking authentically and honestly, drawing from your own experience and using I statements and not speaking for someone else. The next touch point is honoring differences, recognizing that there are differences in communication styles, how we take in information, how our brains process information, and how we speak to one another. There is great diversity in that. There's diversity in experience, and that you can own your own experience, so that differences are not a matter of right or wrong, they're just different. And finally, in a safe community, we can learn how to agree to disagree, where we can hold on to our own identity, our own story, our own feelings, and allow the other person to hold their identity, their story, their feelings, hold on to the relationship, so that even in disagreements, we realize that the relationship is what is most important. And finally, in a safe community, I think it does involve the willingness and the risk in choosing to bend. So I'm going to share this goofy story that kind of illustrated this for me and connected it with this story about Jesus bending with the Canaanite woman. So I've been taking this improv class for sort of my creativity process on Thursday nights for a couple of hours, and we're doing this. We're not really that good, but our coach is like encouraging us, right? Because what happens is sometimes, so you go in and you don't know what your partner's going to do, and you don't know which part, but you're trying to connect with them, and you're trying to figure it out. Sometimes you like lock heads, right? Like you're just disagreeing with each other in improv. There's something funny about disagreements in improv. It's just not cool. It doesn't, like the story gets stuck with what you're doing. And so the coach keeps saying, "Who's going to bet? Who's going to bet? Who's going to bet?" And we're all like, "Oh, that's it." Which is, who wants to see that, right? And then all of a sudden, like, whoa, I need to bend. I need to bend. I can bend. I can have the courage to bend, to move the story forward. So I thought that was an interesting idea. It's I get to choose when I can change. And sometimes, if I have clarity, if I really think a certain way, I can hold my identity. But maybe there are places, it's not about making the other person change, but maybe where are the places where I am willing to bend, where I am willing to change, where I am willing to take a risk. So building a safe community is creating a space and a place where people can feel safe and protected, while also being willing to risk, connecting with one another in deep and meaningful ways, because God invites us into a safe community, into the kingdom where all are loved by God, and people are invited to be in relationship and risk by loving one another. And I think this is the heart of God, and this is the heart of the Jesus way. And just as Jesus is changed, I hope and pray that you may be changed in love as well. Amen.
So, as we move forward with changing kind of the way we do things and gathering, I'm going to invite us to be more